The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
India is still very much front and center in having the strong influence, but I think the challenges that China has really grown its presence, especially as we look at Pakistan, the development of Gwadar, although, not all the projects, and we should point that out too, not all of China's projects have been fully successful. But I think what I looked at in the maritime sphere, you saw greater success levels to compare to perhaps other parts of inland Eurasia as part of the, Eurasian, other parts of the Belt and Road Initiative. But I think, long and short, India is very much going to have to, continue to wrestle with how it competes economically with China.
I'm Alex Vindman, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 4th, 2021. Today, I am pleased to have the opportunity to welcome Dr. Jeffrey Grush for an author talk on his new book, To Rule Eurasia's Waves, The Great Power Competition at Sea. Dr. Jeffrey F. Grush is a professor of international security studies at the College of International Security Affairs, National Defense University in Washington, D.C., with primary research focus on maritime affairs. He has also served as the Department Chair of International Security Studies from 2016 to 2019, and as CISA's Director for South and Central Asia Security Studies Program, 2014 to 2016. I sat down with Dr. Grush to discuss Russia's, China's, and India's interests in their near seas competition cooperation between Russia, China, and India, and the implications of great power competition for U.S. policy. The views expressed by Dr. Grush today do not represent the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, and National Defense University. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 4th. Dr. Jeffrey Grush, To Rule Eurasia's Waves. Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Grush, for joining us to discuss your new book, To Rule Eurasia's Waves, The New Great Power Competition at Sea. I'm very much looking forward to this discussion, as I'm interested in, frankly, a lot of the same topics. So jumping right in, if you ask experts in the foreign policy and national security community about great power competition, too often you hear the answers focus on military or security dimensions. In your excellent, well-written, well-researched book, you focus on the economic dimension. Can you outline your central thesis for the book for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Alex, thanks very much for having me. It's a real honor to be here. So basically, I broke down three main arguments for the book. The first one was very much, as you point out, looking at maritime geoeconomics. The second one is the desire for great power status by Russia, China, India, and in turn kind of altering or undermining, in the case of Russia and China, U.S.-led world order. And the third ties into the kind of economic and security pieces, securing Eurasia's sea lanes of communications. But to the first kind of point, as you point out, maritime geoeconomics. And this is very much economic statecraft. So the tools of economic statecraft and how China, as well as Russia, India for that matter too, are really trying to extend their economic influence globally, from the western reaches of Eurasia to that of East Asia. And that you can look at maritime trade and investment, energy security, and cyber and the sea. And what I've seen, and I had the opportunity to travel pretty extensively, mainly across the southern stretch of Eurasia. I had the opportunity to go to Piraeus in Greece, to Haifa in Israel, to Djibouti, to Sri Lanka, Singapore. So really trying to understand what is going on economically, especially from ports. And what I found was pretty fascinating to see just the sheer amount of investment of these building up these various ports for China, that is specifically for Costco Shipping, one of the main actors, and seeing just how robust, again, still in the early days of the development and planning, but seeing how slowly but surely and quickly in some instances, how these ports are becoming more of a stronger network. They're enabling China to really become an efficient and competitive shipping element. If you think about it from the shipping, you know, industry, it's all about bottom line economics. How can we shave off any amounts of money in our, you know, supply and logistics chain so that we can get goods from one part of the continent to the other as quickly as we can? And I saw this, you know, time and time again, seeing these investments and seeing how Costco buying up a 20% share and then turning into 40% and then turning into a majority share in some cases, or having an extended lease for 99 years in the case of Hambantota, but then also buying up or investing in terminals. So just really seeing that economic piece grow, especially from the Chinese perspective.
That's very interesting. I think there's this Maritime Silk Road concept is not necessarily something that's really widely understood. I think too often we focus on the Bridge and Road Initiative and its terrestrial components, but the access to ports and these long-term leases that the Chinese are acquiring will give them an enduring presence that has both economic and security implications. So it's definitely a very important area to study, but it's likely to lead to conflict and competition as other powers seek to increase their own access, for instance, in what India might believe to be its own privileged sphere of influence. Can you talk about that competition and how it's playing out in the South Seas, the Indian Ocean, and frankly, the sea locks that connect the trade from China all the way through the Arabian Gulf to Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the other thing to point out too, I mean, I think as you know, the challenge for when, especially in this larger competition, relates to the dual use nature of what a lot of what China is doing. So you get these ports, right? And it starts as a geoeconomic investment, which makes good sense. But then it spills over into other security elements that become more concerning for the likes of India, as you mentioned. One of the examples I like to cite is that of Djibouti. And I mentioned, you know, as part of the geoeconomics piece is cyber in the sea. And what many people don't appreciate, there are approximately 200 submarine cable networks that line the globe that connect us internationally. And approximately 95% of all information and data are traversing these cables. 200, which is not very much. If you go to a place like Djibouti, there are approximately 7 or 8 that come in from the ocean floor to, you know, and per when I was there in 2018, seeing that 2 of those were actually controlled and being, you know, run by the Chinese specifically, and then trying to connect from the Mediterranean through the Suez Canal into Djibouti and then to these other nodes along their larger Maritime Silk Road or Belt and Road Initiative in the maritime sphere. And very similar, again, to what the British did back in, you know, the early turn of the 20th century, early 1900s, I think 1902 specifically, when they ran the all-red cable that extended and connected its various outlying colonial outposts together. And so China's doing this through one of its cables called the Peace Cable, which stands for the Pakistan East Africa Connect to Europe Cable. Another name we've seen is the SIWIMI, or Southeast Asia, Middle East, Western Europe Cable. And connecting with, you know, telecommunication firms like Orangetel in France and other very legitimate. But the challenge is that it is then seeping over into the security realm. And you can see, you know, when it comes to India again, being and moving at a quicker pace to try to offset what China's done, especially in some of the smaller Indian Ocean island nations, such as the Seychelles. The Maldives is a critical node and kind of transit point. If you look at the sea lanes of communication, as you point out, I mean, this again, in the shipping industry, time is money. And so there's certain kind of passageways when you're going through the Indian Ocean, one of which goes through the Maldives, and the Chinese investing pretty heavily in a lot of the economics and port development, but also there's the information piece. And as we know, it cuts both ways. When you look at, you know, Huawei is the big one we know in the United States and elsewhere in Europe. These are the firms at the leading edge of putting down these cables, but then also supporting the telecommunications. You look again at the case of Sri Lanka. You know, the Chinese built this big lotus flower tower that's to support the telecommunications of Sri Lanka. But then because there's not the full transparency, it spills it over into other troubling elements. And I think for India in particular, really trying to figure out how to counteract and also manage what they see going on. And they have, you know, I think the one thing for India in particular that's to its advantage is it has a long historical presence. And, you know, there's good reason why we call it the Indian Ocean and not another ocean, because India is still very much front and center and having the strong influence. But I think the challenge is that China has really grown its presence, especially as we, you know, we look at Pakistan, the development of Gwadar, though, you know, not all the projects, and we should point that out too, not all of China's projects have been fully successful. But I think what I looked at in the maritime sphere, you saw greater success levels to compare to perhaps other parts of inland Eurasia as part of the, you know, Eurasian, other parts of the Belt and Road Initiative. But I think, you know, long and short, India is very much going to have to, you know, continue to wrestle with how it competes economically with China.
It's a very interesting topic. I think, you know, China seems to answer some very practical issues as an exporter to, you know, much of the globe by securing these seaports, reducing costs and so forth. India doesn't have that kind of economy, and therefore there's less immediate logic to pursue that kind of access and basing, except to preserve influence. So I wonder if it's likely that, you know, competition may be low in the short term, but it will be increasingly important as India grows and develops and becomes more of a great power competitor in the region, how that is likely to result in conflict and competing interests, and especially as China feels its oats and develops an expeditionary force and a blue water navy. What does the future look like in that region?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think one of the challenges for India from an economic standpoint, you know, you just look at the statistics of transshipment. So the challenge for India right now is that most of the ports that it has are not sufficient in being able to handle these very large cargo carriers or VLCCs. So as a result, India's trade and most of it, you know, I think around 90% of it is actually shipped in from elsewhere. And so it has to transship in other locations. And, you know, for example, 48% of Indian trade is transshipped through Sri Lanka, 29% is transshipped through Singapore, 15% through Malaysia, 4% through the UAE. So that means that A, that costs a lot of money because you have to offload these big carriers and then put them into smaller ships and then send them to India. But then second of all, it means that India is reliant upon a lot of these other countries to transship. And in the case of Sri Lanka, again, you know, China has invested heavily in Colombo port. It hasn't happened today. You know, it's still kind of a long-term thing. But part of the concern, especially when I had a chance to visit, was, well, what happens if China is not as helpful in terms of, you know, letting India easily transship some of its goods through Sri Lanka? That's in turn where you could have some real challenges. And I think India, and through Modi in particular, you know, has many initiatives, some more on paper than others. But you see this real desire, push to move away from kind of interior looking to the north for understandable reasons, just because of the conflict with China as well as Pakistan and Kashmir, but trying to embrace India's blue economy. You know, this program, the Sagarmala, of really also working with other Indian Ocean nations to build up the blue water economic network that India has yet to really fully leverage. So I think there's great potential for the future. you know, as we know, as anybody's traveled to India, the bureaucracy is massive. Sometimes it's inefficient. I mean, that's the definition of any good bureaucracy. But I think in India's case, it's really been hindered by it. And until it's able to kind of build and expand a lot of its ports, this is going to be a real vulnerability for the future.
So we're going to maybe rewind and take a step back and ask kind of a basic question. Why did you choose Russia, China, and India versus, incorporating the United States? It's always good to look through a different lens, but why those three and maybe even supranational bodies like the EU as an element of great power competition?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, as we know, there's so many great books on the United States, on grand strategy, on the role of the United States. And one of my first books that I wrote about was U.S. Military Basing Politics. You know, and I think for this particular book, the United States always kind of fit into the background, but I felt as if there was not as much on these rising Eurasian powers, specifically India, China, and Russia. And I come at it from the lens, too, of, you know, looking at Eurasia from a very much, you know, Mackinder-esque, the world island perspective, but flipping it on its head or changing the paradigm to look at the maritime space. Because if you look at Mackinder, he was very much, you know, the heartland. Or you look at Nicholas Speakman, who looked and, you know, he said, who controls the Rimland rules Eurasia. Who controls Eurasia controls the destinies of the world. But neither Mackinder nor Speakman looked at the Arctic. And so, you know, what I began to see over the years is as the Arctic really begins to melt, Russia stands to gain, you know, front and center. But then seeing China as a non-Arctic power be increasingly interested, you know, obviously issuing the Polar Silk Road, whatever that means, but nevertheless, signaling that it has strong interest in the Arctic, has begun to really increase investment. So looking at these great geographers, and of course, Alfred Thermahan and his sea power theory, of course, always important in all this too, but trying to look at Eurasia from, you know, the maritime perspective and how it's increasingly unified, you know, when the Arctic was frozen for many more months, if not the entire year, and seeing that change pretty rapidly. And so that's why wanting to focus more on these, you know, non-US, non-Western powers, because I think, you know, to go back to your point about the EU, you know, everything's run through the NATO, as you know, intimately. And, you know, I think for NATO and its maritime command, it's readapting to the kind of new forces that it's starting to see with Russia becoming much more of a, you know, stronger maritime player in Western Europe. But also, you know, one of the examples I frequently cite too are these joint sea exercises that have taken place between Russia and China over the last couple of years. And in 2015, for example, China and Russia hosted their first joint sea exercise in the Mediterranean. In 2017, they hosted the joint sea exercise in the Baltic Sea, but also at the same time taking place in other far reaches of East Asia, the two countries together. So seeing how there's a lot more activity going on in the high seas and trying to understand what's going on. And as you pointed out at the beginning, you know, the top of the conversation, it's not just a military phenomenon that we're seeing. We're seeing very much economics as front and center. But then quickly, the security element is falling into line.
Yeah, it's you broke into several different issues that I want to get into a little more detail here shortly. But I'd be curious to just hear your brief outline on the desires of Russia, China, and India individually in their maritime domains before we start talking about more complex issues about the interrelationships, historical relationships between Russia and India. India and China and so forth. So maybe could you touch on kind of that bigger picture briefly?
Yeah. And I think, you know, you point out too that there are complex relationships between all the three powers. But I think for India front and center, It is concerned about being completely surrounded and powerless in the event of the outbreak of a two-front war, right? So that'd be a war along its northern borders. And we've seen in their right to be concerned about that, in the sense that we've seen the outbreak of skirmishes along its northern boundaries in the Ladakh, as well as growing, always kind of perpetual tension with Pakistan to the west. But China and Pakistan having very strong ties, and China investing in the CPEC, or the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, to varying degrees of success, certainly. But that's a pretty strong stalwart relationship that India is concerned about. And so as China kind of moves further into the Indian Ocean, and, you know, there's some speculation that China could launch missiles into the Bay of Bengal that could put Indian ships really at risk. So I think this is a real wake-up call for India to try to manage not only what it's doing on its northern borders, but really being forced to push into the Indian Ocean. And I think for China, you know, it gets complicated certainly with the South China Sea and the various disputes that are ongoing with the contested islands in East Asia. But I think, you know, at the beginning, as I point out, it's very much motivated by economics, that it has a, you know, up until now, those population has slowed ever so slightly. But over the long term, it needs vast, significant amounts of natural resources to fuel its economy. And so in order to do that, it must really expand outward into parts of Africa. And certainly the energy security piece is huge. And so expanding more into Southwest Asia or the Middle East. And then, of course, trade implications when it comes to Europe. So I think the economic piece is enormous, but of course that spills into the real challenges tied to security issues of the South China Sea, specifically tension over Taiwan and tensions with Japan. And then for Russia, I mean, the debate has been ongoing about how we view Russia. Is it a spoiler? Is it also a great power? I think the reality is that Russia, through its maritime program, it has enormous great power aspirations, but its naval development program has certainly hit administrative roadblocks. That being said, one element of its naval development program, submarines, have by and large been rather successful, though they've had certain accidents, tragic, you know, accidents. But, you know, to give an example, currently they have six classes of submarines under development, compared to the United States that has just one class of submarines. So its submarine program, which at the height of the Soviet Union was one of its greatest, is still able to use its submarine power to kind of be stealthy, to expand well beyond its regional seas underneath the Arctic ice pack. And so I think, you know, the submarine program will continue to be important. And, you know, when we get into more military elements of anti-access aerial denial, A2AD capabilities, the submarines are really at the forefront of this, because in my understanding, many of them can kind of penetrate some of the lines of A2AD more successfully than traditional warships. So I think, and some, those are the various elements. And I think throw in the last piece here related to Russia, as a rentier state, it is sitting on massive amounts of oil and gas, and certainly extracting that from the Arctic, you know, benefits the large contracts with China, but then also helping other countries selling oil and gas, or developing, you know, capabilities to extract oil or gas offshore, they have certainly a corner in parts of the market that can be very helpful from an economic standpoint.
Sure. So I think we have some more depth we could cover, both maybe a little bit more in the Indian Ocean and the Arctic. But before we go there, I'd be curious to hear about these traditional relationships of cooperation between Russia and India, and competition between India and China. That's maybe a simplistic wave tops assessment, but Russia still has a robust military cooperation, arms sales program with India that has to concern China. You know, certainly both China and India have benefited from acquisition of Soviet era aircraft carriers to develop those kinds of programs. I guess I'm curious as to whether those traditional cooperative or competitive relationships are likely to hold, especially as India and China enter probably a period of decades of increased competition as rising India in certain ways deflects the growth of China.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think that's going to be the fundamental question moving forward about how are these historical relationships going to play out moving forward. And as I talk about, you know, I think there are ways, especially from a U.S. centric standpoint, about driving greater amounts of wedges between Russia and China. And I think, you know, one of my former advisors used to refer to the Sino-Russian relationship as, are you into classical music at all?
I am.
So a fugue, right? Mm-hmm. So where the fugue, the notes kind of, you know, depart and then they come back together in unison, and then they depart and they come back together. And I think that's a really nice, eloquent way of looking at the Sino-Russian relationship. Right now, they're closer together because they have more of a shared interest. Over time, I think that remains to be seen. There are certain points of tension that haven't necessarily come out. But I think to go back to the original question on Russia and India, for example, this is very much one you're seeing kind of play out in live stream of India being, you know, historically non-aligned and really being an independent actor, but seeing how it must move at some level closer to the United States. And that was certainly exhibited in just most recently, and they do it every year, the annual Malabar naval exercises, which this year took place in the Bay of Bengal. And this year is significant because it took place with the United States, India certainly, but Japan and then Australia was included for the first time since 2007. So I think India is trying to balance this relationship. I don't think it's an easy one. And I think, as you point out too, I mean, that's pretty significant that two former Soviet aircraft carriers, one being used or retrofitted for the Indian Navy, the other one retrofitted and overhauled for the Chinese Navy. So very much, you know, Russia has a hand to play in this. And I don't think India wants to give up that relationship because it, you know, as you point out, that Russia does have significant technologies that India can benefit from. But I think the larger tectonic shifts are such that India will likely have to kind of move closer to the United States to balance some of the dynamics, especially as Russia and China develop more interoperability capabilities. You know, again, the Joint Sea Exercise is a good indication or symbol of this growing enhancement of the relationship, and India, you know, also having to kind of move in a similar fashion.
Sure. You know, it strikes me that India, in fact, is kind of the centerpiece, or could be the centerpiece of a balancing strategy for both Russia and the U.S. With regards to China. I mean, somewhere always in the back of Russia's mind is the fear of a rising China, whose role certainly creeps much more substantially into Russia's privileged sphere of influence. That's an area where they've kind of found their lanes in the road. For instance, in Central Asia, for the time being, there's an adequate accommodation. But I think as global warming affects the Siberian plain and makes that a more kind of a vibrant location to settle, there's going to be pressure on Russia from China and that massive demographic pool. And Russia has that somewhere probably in the back of its mind. And of course, the U.S., you know, has concerns about Chinese influence in the region and how to potentially offset that. And I wonder if that could be, you know, if there is some accommodation to be made with regards to our respective relationships, the United States and Russia, as a way to offset or hedge against Chinese power.
Yeah, I think it's certainly something to watch out for. You know, as many people point out too, that Russia really needs China much more than perhaps China needs Russia. And I think since 2014, the takeover of Crimea, the increased sanctions on Russia, it's made it harder for Russia to kind of maneuver within the larger global sphere. And so that being said, I think Russia still, you know, pushing and supporting various weapons programs, or we haven't talked about the establishment of a base for Russia that is in Port Sudan. So clearly Russia has been hindered to some extent with the rise of sanctions, increased sanctions. But at the same time, it's been pretty smart about how to maneuver around that such that it has a increased global power projection, albeit imperfect. But as I, cite at the beginning of the book, one of the maritime strategies that I think in couple with Mahan's sea power theory is that of the French Je n'Ecole, which uses smaller, maneuverable, submersible type craft that can still be, play a significant role when going up against, greater, more powerful entities, especially in the naval domain.
So I think let's maybe jump over to the template established by your table of contents, and your chapters go from the Baltic Sea and Black Sea onto the Mediterranean. And I'd like to get your thoughts on those bodies of water that I think the West is most familiar with: Russia's domination of the Black Sea, its foray and increasing influence into the Mediterranean, certainly the Eastern Mediterranean, but frankly, a play for Central Mediterranean. So please share your thoughts on those bodies of water and a great power competition there.
Yeah, so I think, again, since 2014, Russia has been able to really solidify its maritime power in the Black Sea by taking over Crimea, by, being much more dominant, not only militarily or navally, but also in the geoeconomic realm again of taking over. I think it nationalized one of the oil or gas fields, the Palas field off of Ukraine, worth tens of billions of dollars. But then using that as a, secure jumping off platform into the Mediterranean. And then this coupled with what took place in Syria, where the Russians were able to establish a more permanent long-term presence in Tartus in Syria. And so almost overnight, Russia being a more prominent actor in the Eastern Mediterranean, and then using it to kind of build historic relationships, as you point out, implicitly with Libya, much more engaged with what's going on in Libya, much more engaged with what's going on in Egypt, and then springboarding, as I point out just moments ago, looking at what it's doing in the Red Sea. So I think this enables, Russia to be much more of a proactive player. And I think if you put this in juxtaposition to what NATO's force looks like, and it only has, four maritime groups that comprise of 2 to 7 ships, depending on the NATO member nation. The U.S. 6th Fleet, we have 1 command ship and 4 destroyers. So I think, quickly coming up to parity on top of, again, Russia investing in its submarine program to be much more present in the Mediterranean. So I think the challenge, and this is one of the elements that I write too, is that because of this push for great power status to undermine, in the case of Russia, a U.S.-led world order, one of the spillover effects is rising navalism. And it's a term that it's been long in our lexicon, but we haven't necessarily seen it deployed as much. And this is very much naval development, weapons, cyber technology, ships and sub-development, carriers, but also greater naval activity, joint exercises, naval diplomacy, and solo expeditions. And I think also more aggressive behavior that we're seeing too. And the challenge with more aggressive behavior is it could lead to an inadvertent accident, or it could lead to a deliberate accident. And if that leads to a deliberate accident, then it could quickly escalate into something more robust than just, 2 naval ships being aggressive, or in most cases, Russia being aggressive towards the United States. And we've seen several instances, not only in the Black Sea, but also in the Far East too. So I think that's going to be very troubling. And I think right now NATO is trying to figure out how it's adapting, and it has been adapting over the last couple of years, but also expanding, really bringing back the Northern Atlantic Treaty Organization of doing more in the Atlantic Ocean, which is pretty fascinating. But nevertheless, I think the Mediterranean, because it's a small, you know, oceanic space, especially when you're traveling through the Bosphorus or the Suez Canal, the Eastern Mediterranean, there's a lot of overlap. And this just becomes more of a dicey area where the likelihood for potential, you know, interactions could be problematic.
That's a very interesting point. I think it's interesting and surprising probably that there hasn't been more of a show of force by or miscalculation on the part of the Russians. In the Black Sea, they tend to challenge U.S. presence. They follow U.S. aircraft and naval forces. And, you know, at times, certainly in the Soviet period, there were collisions and so forth. There's been some harassment of U.S. presence in the Black Sea. It hasn't extended out into the Mediterranean, but it has occurred in the Far East. Do you have kind of a thought as to, you know, these are very different dynamics and very different interests involved? Russia is trying to demonstrate its authority in the Black Sea. That the Pacific incident that occurred within the past few years is quite remote. Maybe to put it this way, so far we've benefited from this little bullet, big sky theory, where there's just a lot of open water and little contact, and only in those places where one party or another feel their interests keen do they kind of challenge or signal. That's likely to change based on increased Russian presence and the response from NATO and the U.S. Could you talk a little bit about how that's likely to play out?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And let me give an example, not in the Black Sea or the Mediterranean, but let's move to the closer to the United States off the coast of Alaska. This past summer in August of 2020, the Russians were conducting what they call Ocean Shield, where they had 50 warships traversing the Bering Sea. And then there's later reporting that came out about the incident in November. But what happened was that the Russian ships crossed over into U.S. EEZs, exclusive economic zones, and started harassing U.S. fishermen. And the U.S. fishermen getting on the line, calling back to the Coast Guard saying, "What's going on?" And the Coast Guard saying, "Well, just come back to shore. We don't want to see any escalation. We can't really support you further." So I think in this, we see also the Chinese having a similar playbook, or perhaps the ones who originated the playbook in the South China Sea, all these various islands, of using its maritime militia to be aggressive towards small fishermen from the Philippines or wherever it may be, to kind of control and dominate the area. So I think you're correct, you know, to go back to the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. We've seen instances in the Black Sea. We haven't seen the same aggression in the Mediterranean, but I think it's certainly possible. That being said, I mean, what's always fascinating about choke points is that all countries rely at some level upon you know, these valuable choke points. So messing up or, you know, shutting down or making it more difficult to traverse choke points can often be against one country's own interests. So I think I would imagine Russia is having to kind of play delicately at some level. More importantly, again, I mean, it goes back to this, you know, we start out with, there's huge economics. And so, you know, Russia stands to gain just as much as China. And so trying to feel out the economic space, benefit from that front and center, you know, is only going to be of direct benefit then to kind of building up its security forces, of, you know, making sure that its Navy is in a much more established position. As we know, again, its naval development program has not been as strong as they perhaps would have liked. And that's, you know, due to fluctuations in budget. So I think any ways where they can bring in more money into the kind of mainline coffers, all the better from a naval development standpoint.
That's interesting. I think in the very busy news cycle, the Ocean Shield exercise and the harassment of Alaskan fishermen is something that was largely overlooked. But frankly, I think by the community of Russia analysts was noted. And I think that the assessment is generally we've let our capabilities, the U.S. and except for a few partners in NATO and in the EU, we've frankly lacked the capability to challenge Russian and or Chinese assertiveness in those high seas. The Chinese that don't have any real kind of access or seemingly legitimate claim to the Arctic are building more capability in the Arctic than the United States that does have a terrestrial claim on the Arctic. So maybe this is a good opportunity to shift over into the Arctic and the implications of global warming, the increased transit and Russia's assertiveness over the North Sea route and desire to extract anything from economic benefit from transit or, you know, exploit the hydrocarbons and so forth in the region. Let's maybe hear a little bit about your views on the Arctic and how competition is likely to play out there between these powers.
So I think it's true. And as I point out, you know, this kind of is the future frontier, especially when it comes to Eurasia and the maritime space. For the moment, it is very much geoeconomically driven. There's as you point out, there's such a vast, natural resources, oil and gas for Russia to extract, but there are also valuable natural minerals such as diamonds or nickel or others, and then a huge fishery stock. You know, there's something like 240 different types of fish species. And as the oceans warm, a lot of these cold water fish, cod in particular, really flourishes in a cold water environment, are pushing further north. So for right now, it's certainly managed through the Arctic Council. But I think, you know, over time, as the ice melts, and we just saw in the last couple of weeks that as the Northern Sea Route closed over, it was open for the largest amount of time, 121 days, I think, largest they've ever seen in recent memory. And again, to go back, time is money. So, you know, if you're able to traverse the Northern Sea Route, that you're saving around $500,000 per trip. And this would be 23 versus 34 days when you traditionally have to go through the Suez Canal. So you're saving significant amounts of money. So this, you know, makes sense why Russia certainly, which has something like more than 50% of the geography, equally between Canada and Russia, I think they possess 80% of the territory up there. And then the other countries kind of thrown in, but there's huge economic potential. In addition to that, which is really fascinating, which many don't appreciate, that also the melting Arctic is tied into the monsoon patterns of the Indian Ocean. So there's good reason why Singapore or India, for that matter, wants to be an observer nation, which it became along with China as the Arctic Council, because by doing more research of the Arctic and understanding those patterns and how they connect into the monsoons down in the Indian Ocean is very important from an economic standpoint, not only from a climate science standpoint, and something why there's so much more general interest in the high north.
As we approach the close of our very interesting conversation, I'd like maybe to hear your thoughts as a professor at the National Defense University, keenly interested and involved in the policy discussions on great power competition in the maritime domain. What are maybe some conclusions and prescriptions that you would offer as an expert in this area for the United States and for our alliance structure in these various locations or with these various state partners or competitors?
So I think that's exactly it. You know, and as I pointed out previously, it is very much going to have to be, for the United States at least, investing, and not only invest, but really putting money where our mouth is, of partner nations and allies. And so, you know, again, looking at the Malabar exercise, for example, I think that India, Australia, Japan are going to be important anchor nations in the larger kind of Indo-Pacific that will be critical in the future. Again, promoting interoperability. I mean, it's a real something tangible that the United States can look to in the event of some sort of outbreak of conflict where we can easily, the United States, that is, go and work quickly with these other partners and allies. So I think that that's going to be very critical. In addition to that, in the non-military sense, I think the United States very much needs to redeploy much more of its commercial diplomacy and its economic tools of statecraft. As we know, the State Department over the past, you know, several years, its budget has been depleted significantly. And, you know, I often cite, you know, there was certain optimism of moving over from, I think it's OPIC to the IFDC, the $6 billion budget, that was going to be a way to compete against China's Belt and Road Initiative. We've seen very little play in that sphere. So I think any ways for the United States to think and invest more in these economic tools of various agencies, and I think also the Commerce Department. The Commerce Department promotes, you know, U.S. businesses abroad. One of the examples I like to cite, the case of Israel and Haifa. Many years ago, the Israelis actually did a soft reach out to several U.S. firms when they wanted to call for proposals or tenders to expand the terminal. And they reached out to U.S. firms and they said, well, thanks, but no thanks. We don't want, we're not interested in the project. And then, of course, who came in and took the project? It was the Chinese. And then, of course, fast forward in the United States, you know, I think there was a retired admiral who came in and said, I'm not going to park, you know, naval, or I wouldn't, if I were the commander of the Sixth Fleet, I wouldn't come here with my ships because it's a security risk, a security vulnerability. So I think, you know, in over the next decade or so, one of the citations is something like $94 trillion in infrastructure money and investment that's a potential possibility. So for the United States to kind of unlock strategically in a smart fashion for all to benefit would really do have long-term dividends to kind of compete or manage what we're seeing play out, certainly in the economic sphere. So I think a combination of being smart about how we use our militaries, and, you know, to go back to that piece too, as we point out, the U.S. military, according to, you know, the base structure report of 2018, I think, which is put up with Congress, there are approximately 500 or 512 main operating bases around the world. You know, and I think thinking about how we realign a base, as you know, is very expensive to run and operate outside the United States. So figuring out ways to kind of maneuver, move some of these bases around to align with the changing dynamics on the ground, I think equally should fit into this larger equation. And then the last piece, you know, you always, you know, we go back to the Ocean Shield incident. I think investing more in the Coast Guard is also critical. Certainly the U.S. Navy plays an important role, but the U.S. Coast Guard is an enormous player that is underappreciated. It's not nearly as expensive. They already do a lot of great bilateral, multilateral partner capacity building programs, managing it and, you know, the various EEZs of partner nations, et cetera. And I think the Coast Guard could be a critical arm in this kind of larger great power competition.
So this has been an excellent discussion on a terrific book. Dr. Gresh, thank you again for joining us at Lawfare.
Thanks again for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk big picture Eurasian geopolitics, especially from a maritime perspective.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha Howell. Our audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.